God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. So the Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance today. Newcomers, is there anyone here in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would just like to welcome you by first name. Feel free to unmute and say hello.
Hello, everybody. Marcus, and I'm an alcoholic. Thanks for letting me join the group, I'm happy to read tonight. The AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Thank you, sir. All right. The format of this meeting is an open speaker ask it basket. Tonight, we're very excited to have Susie from Seal Beach, California, come and tell her story. And after she does that, we'll take a short break, call for announcements, Seven Tradition, etc. And then we'll reconvene and we'll ask questions for the last part of the meeting. So please feel free to send your questions through the chat to the user questions. So Susie, I've been looking forward to this all week. I don't want to take up another minute of your time. Thank you for coming to share with us tonight.
You're so funny. Oh my God, David. Hi, I'm Susie. I'm an alcoholic. Shall I say I'm glad to be here? Yeah. Okay. I want to welcome anybody that's even fairly new. I mean, this is the greatest journey in the world. I mean, I can't believe how great this journey is. If you're new and not so new, I hope you jump in here with both feet. It's certainly more fun to jump here and have a good time than, you know, be on the sidelines and judge the people who are doing it. And I found that from my own experience. I've had a great time in Alcoholics Anonymous and not so much before I got to AA. Those last few years were pretty rough. But if you knew, some of the things that I learned right away is I could drive a car at night. I thought, oh my God, I can see at night. I thought that was so amazing. I knew the people that I was sleeping with when I got sober. That was a little better too. And the thing about Alcoholics Anonymous for me is that I am grateful that I tried everything before coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. The first thing in my life was religion. I'd been a Christian Scientist. I was raised a Christian Scientist, and I'd been a Baptist, Lutheran, Presbyterian. And what was my big one? Oh, I converted to Judaism in the synagogue where the Pacific Group has been meeting for years. And my name in the synagogue is Hannah. That's the book of life after being Jewish. And none of it ever stopped me from drinking or slowed me down, you know. The other thing I did a lot of is I went to a lot of therapists. My first, I guess, psychologist was when I was 10 or 11 years old. And my parents took me there because I was I was throwing myself on the floor a lot. And I was throwing a lot of tantrums. I know my sponsee Rennie's here. She's probably seen a lot of this. But anyway, and so they took me to my first psychologist at 10 or 11. And they put me on these old drugs called Miltown and Librium. Some of you older people might remember those. And so from that age to when I got sober, I really didn't know much about what was going on in the world. I did not. I wasn't totally aware. When I got sober, I didn't even know who the president of the United States was. Not that it made any difference, but I didn't know much except a lot of self-centeredness for years and years. My parents both died of alcoholism. My mother was put in the motion picture home out here in the San Fernando Valley, and she had alcohol dementia. It was hideous to watch. And I have a grandmother who died of alcoholism, and I'm the only one that's been sober in my family. I don't have a big family, but I'm the only one sober. So for this journey, I started drinking when I was 15. I was still on Liberman Milltown, drinking at 15 on beer. I love Country Club beer. That's another old beer. Man, that stuff was good. And my first drunk was, I drove to the beach with several girlfriends. I was 15, but I took my parents' car and put out a cigarette on my girlfriend because I was so drunk. And that's kind of the beginnings for me. Now, I didn't drink every day at 15 years old. I was in school. I went to school. I went to high school. I even got good grades. But anytime I could drink, I drank. I loved it. I thought drinking was sophisticated, romantic. You know, those old movies with people coming down these big staircases with these cigarette holders and a martini. Oh, my God. I loved it. I wanted to be like that. I don't know anything about social drinking. Nothing. Never done it, ever. But I thought it looked like beautiful to have that kind of image. Well, I never got that. So I graduated from high school, got good grades, did all that, was popular, had fun. And then, you know, my drinking progressed. My drinking changed every few years, got worse and worse and worse. And I'm sure some of you know that if you've been in and out of this program like I have. So after I went to college for a couple of years, I want to tell you something, that thing scared me to death. Those people looked like they knew what they were doing. I had no idea what I was doing. I didn't have any idea about life. I loved the parties because there was a lot of drinking going on at college, as most of you probably know. And then what I did is I decided, another decision by me, that if I just quit college and got married, that was the answer. That'll do it. I'd been going with this guy in high school and college for 5 years, and I really knew that that was the one, and that we would sail off into the sunset and have this magic, wonderful life. He would mow the lawn, we'd have a white picket fence, you know, all that great stuff. He'd mow the lawn. I've never known anything that kind of, I don't know anything about that kind of life at all. It looked good, but I'd watched a lot of those old shows, you know, like Father Knows Best, where the man is in a suit and the woman's in her heels and they're saying goodnight to their kids and their dressed up outfits. I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, what they showed us back then in the 50s. Anyway, so I got married. This guy, we'd gone together a long time. We were in love, but alcohol can really ruin any of that, I'll tell you. And we had two kids, two boys that were born, and I delivered both those kids drunk at St. John's Hospital in Santa Monica. They're 4 years apart, and I was drunk for the first one, and I was drunk for the second one. That is something I was never going to tell anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. That was so shameful. I didn't talk about it for a long time. Of course, it was in my inventory, but I didn't talk about it. And you know, I have one child, my second son, that had a lot of learning disabilities. And every doctor, counselor, school nurse told me it was my fault. It was my drinking. And it was. And I'll tell you, for years, I felt guilty about that. He's probably one of my favorite kids now, but I don't feel as guilty anymore. He's got the greatest personality and he's so in the middle of life. And I just thought that was not going to happen for him because of disabilities that I had caused him. But time heals. It really does. So during that marriage, I decided that what I would do is become a gourmet cook. And gourmet cooks always cook with a lot of wine, right? Alcohol. So I became a gourmet cook, never realizing really what I was doing at the time. That's what's so hysterical. And so I would make, sauerbraten and baked Alaska and all these things that have alcohol in them. And what happened to me is pretty soon I started making dinner in the morning. Aha, a little wine for me, a little wine for the pot. Never once thought I had a problem with alcohol. And yet every night that man came home, I offered him a drink at the door because I already had some. So, you know, I did things like he took me to to some of the parties for his business. And I remember once I was, pregnant with our first child and I'd had a little bit too much to drink. I was pregnant too. And they had this long dinner table and they had all these beautiful salads in front of us. I sat down, I fell right in the salad in front of me. And of course everybody excused me because I was pregnant. You know, this is the kind of stuff that went on and on and on. Anyway, This husband divorced me on the grounds of alcoholism, which they could do way back then. I had those papers that said alcoholism. I was, oh my God, I didn't even know what an alcoholism was. He left me with a 2-week-old and a 4-year-old. And let me tell you, I was not ready for reality at all, not at all. But, you know, now I knew I could drink like I wanted to because nobody was watching, you know, and I had to go to work and I had to make a living. And that started a series of jobs that happened to me. I went to work at law firms and in Los Angeles, where I was living at the time. I was born and raised in Los Angeles. And there's thousands of lawyers in LA, and I've worked for most of them. I was either getting fired or just drinking in front of something, always. And well, what happened was, you know, my drinking was in trouble for a long time. Okay, those law firms were, one law firm, the boss asked me to come in on a Saturday morning, and I thought I had a right to bring in my vodka. Why not, you know? And now, you know, I was carrying it with me, and I went into this law firm and I sat down, I was going to say behind the typewriter, but that's what it was way back then. Yowie, that dates me. And it was a Saturday. So I came in early and I got that brown paper bag right up to my mouth, and in the boss walked and I was fired. That's the kind of stuff that started happening to me. My drinking again gets worse after having 2 kids and being alone, you know, that loneliness and 2 kids, and, you know, I'm losing friends. I'm not doing what I'm supposed to be doing at all. And the thing, and finally, I got into a law firm at the end, not in the middle of my end of my drinking, actually. This law firm had 8 lawyers in it. And my boss told me that if I did a good day's worth of work, he would have a water glass full of bourbon waiting for me at the end of the day. I didn't miss time from this job. Other jobs, I'd come in if I wanted to, or I'd get lost on the freeway, you know, go into a blackout. I love this job. I didn't miss any Mondays or Fridays. I was there and I would do my work. And then we'd go in his office and have this water glass full of bourbon. And you know how that is. It's like being in a bar. You start philosophizing and talking about things you shouldn't talk about. And anyway, my fifth step is in this law firm. I was with all 8 of those lawyers. And what happened to me is they asked me to leave. Can you imagine? Oh my God, I was in trouble. But before I left that law firm, my boss invited all the office over to a, you know, a swimming party on a Sunday. And I didn't like Sundays. I just thought they were so empty and alone. And people looked like they knew what they were doing. And I didn't know what I was doing. I felt alone, and people looked happy. They were doing things with their families. Sundays were miserable for a long time. So I drank. Right now, I had to drink before I go to this party. It's in the San Fernando Valley, and I don't go to the Valley very often because I can't drive real well. And I went to the party, and I'd had too much to drink already, and I dove in that swimming pool. And, you know, we're swimming around. We're having a good time with the office. And I have a few more drinks, and he has a barbecue pit that's down, you know, built into the ground. Beautiful, big barbecue pit. And the barbecue pit is going, but it doesn't have the grill on it. And I slipped and fell in that barbecue pit. And I was so drunk, I couldn't get out. I was severely burned all down my right side. I still have scars. I spent 8 weeks at UCLA putting sulfa on and taking lots of painkillers. Burns are awful. But I never thought drinking had anything to do with it. I thought it was just an accident at my boss's house. You know, that's kind of the way my drinking went. I didn't stop drinking because of the barbecue pit. I mean, I should have actually, but I did not. And right after that, a neighbor of mine kind of noticed that I kind of smelled funny on Saturday mornings. And I usually had an early drink on Saturday mornings, even though I had these 2 kids. And she came over and she 12-stepped me. She was in the program of Al-Anon, and she told me about Alcoholics Anonymous. And to be honest, I hadn't heard a word about Alcoholics Anonymous in my life. I was only, 27, 26 years old, I think. And I called Central Office in Los Angeles, which is a wonderful central office and large. And they advised me, they thought maybe I should go to Friendly House, which is a woman's 12-step house in Los Angeles. It's the oldest 12-step house in California. And I decided to go. My parents took care of my kids, my two little boys. And off I went. And I learned so much at Friendly House about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was run by this big Texas woman. She liked me or something. She made me follow her around everywhere she went. And she was, you know, loud and fun. And I don't know. I just learned so much there. And I stayed an extra 2 weeks because she asked me to. So I spent 2 months there. And I got out of there. My parents, I said, took my kids. And I got out there. And boy, it's after being in treatment for two, or woman's house. It's not treatment. I never went to treatment. And I went home. And I really wasn't ready for the real world. I don't know. I was scared and I didn't know what to do. And I did start going to meetings in West Los Angeles at Ohio Street, which is kind of a fun place to be. But I would go there. First of all, I'd take the inventory of the speaker, which don't do that anymore. Not at all. And I kept listening. If you're new or not so new, I kept listening for the differences, you know. I thought that I was just a nice girl who drank too much, and people were talking about character. They were talking about all this stuff and God and get a sponsor. And I thought, no, I don't need any of that. I can do this on my own, right? It's the biggest problem with this disease of that denial part. Oh my God. I just couldn't imagine that I could be an alcoholic. So I left Ohio Street one Wednesday night after the meeting. I had 4 months of sobriety. And I thought if I just drank wine, I'd be okay. Now, I've never done much wine, so I bought a half gallon, because that's what an alcoholic would drink, right? Half gallon of vin rosé, man. Woo! And I finished the half gallon that night. That was pretty rough, I'll tell you something. I woke up with a terrible hangover. Oh, God, my thing went off. My timer. I woke up with a terrible, terrible hangover. And I heard about the morning drink in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And I thought, well, if I just have a drink, everything's going to be okay, right? So I had a little bit of vodka before I went. And what started for me was blackouts every day. And this is why, for me, Alcoholics Anonymous is the easier, softer way. It's so much easier to know what's going on than trying to take care of two kids, a job. I was losing my car. I was losing the kids. I didn't know what was going on in my life at all. So I found this really true, that it's easier to be sober than to be trying to figure out what's going on in your life. Because I wanted to look good. I wanted to be okay. You know, all that stuff. I had to keep that job for the kids. Where were the kids? Where was the car? Anyway, this is the easier, softer way. So I don't even know where I was just then. After leaving AA, yeah. I went in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for 3.5 years, thinking that my case was different. And most of you know that's the fastest way out of here. I thought my case was different. I thought I could handle it. I didn't need a sponsor, blah, blah, blah. I went to meetings drinking, which not as a good idea either. And I just couldn't quite get it. My life was really pretty miserable. And what happened to me after leaving Alcoholics Anonymous is I felt pretty bad at Christmas time. Christmas time was alone. And I know some of you know the true loneliness of an alcoholic. And the Christmas Eve after leaving AA again, I put those two little kids in a car and I got under the freeway. I have no idea where I was going to date, but the cops were right there. I think I hit the car in front of me. I can't even remember. And I fell out. I fell right out when they opened the door. And they took me to the women's prison, the women's jail in downtown Los Angeles called Sybil Brand. And I'll tell you something. I stood in that drunk tank. I was sober in a couple of minutes. I couldn't believe how many people were there. Women were there on a Christmas Eve. The place was full. But thank God I'd worked for lawyers, you know. I called my boss. Lawyers came in handy these last few years. And my boss came and got me on Christmas morning just before they were going to spray me down. And I thought, oh my God, my kids were taken to McLaren Hall, which is a place for children. And my parents picked them up. And, you know, I can almost remember that morning. It was Christmas morning. And I hated who I'd become. I hated the mother I had become. I had absolutely no self-worth. I didn't want to be around at all. And it's Christmas. And my parents say to me, well, maybe you can't just drink for today. And I thought, no, I have to kill these feelings. I can't stand who I was. I had to drink. Of course I had to do. Those last 3 years of drinking, well, 2 years for sure. I drank a quart of vodka every day. And boy, did that feel secure having that vodka with me. What happened was I bought a large purse, you know, so the quart of vodka could fit right on the bottom. And I would take that purse and go in the restroom and stand in that stall and drink warm vodka every day. That's what had happened to me. And at the end of my drinking too, I was having a hard time, as I've Kevin explained, keeping it together. And I'd have a little vodka and get in the shower and have a little more. And I got out, thought I was really doing okay. But I was really not liking what I saw in the mirror. And I started wearing a lot of makeup, you know, just to cover up the way I was feeling. And I tried false eyelashes. And when you're drinking, it's pretty hard to put on false eyelashes. And I put one here and one up here. And, you know, they'd be all over my face. And I thought, wow, I look really good. It was amazing what I did to feel okay, you know, to make myself okay. And at that time, I went back to therapy thinking, I need some help, definitely. I remember one time I ran into the cars on one of my local streets. I ran into the cars, I hit them all, and I lost my front teeth. And it happened to be Halloween. And my kids thought I looked so cute that night because I didn't have any front teeth. I looked like the witch for Halloween. That's the kind of stuff I got in trouble with. My car that I bought 2 years to three years before I got sober was a brand new Toyota. And I didn't go anywhere because I can't see and drive at the same time. I mean, drink and drive at the same time. It doesn't work very well. But you should have seen this car. When I got sober, there were no aerials, no bumpers. The fender was gone. And I didn't have any mileage on it. When I traded that car in, the guy looked at this car and he said, wow, look at all what you've done to the body. But the engine was in perfect condition because I couldn't do anything. It was fun, the funniest thing that happened. Oh my God. All right. So I went back to therapy, did everything, did all the religion stuff, never told anybody how I drank for sure. Right. So I remember it was my 30th birthday. And this was the end of my drinking. I'm telling you, it was horrible. I'd just been fired from another job from lawyers. Love those guys, right? And this new boss said, you know, if you come over, you know, we'll just have a little wine and we'll decorate the tree. And it's your birthday. My birthday is 4 days before Christmas. He said, oh, come over, we'll decorate the tree. I didn't even know the guy, right? Just starting work for this guy. And so I thought, well, you know, I could go over there. He just wants to have a little wine. That's not my problem. My problem's vodka. And he only lived 2 miles from my house. So I thought I could do this. I really did. So I drove over there, decorated the tree, drank wine. I don't remember anything about the evening, that's for sure. And when I came out, I knew I was having trouble. I had, you know, I did the one eye thing when I got on the streets. I couldn't quite see. And the cops picked me up for going too slow. And they threw me in the Santa Monica drunk tank on my 30th birthday. And I'll tell you something. I had no friends left. Nobody, my parents stopped helping me. Nothing was going on in my life at all. It was horrible, horrible. And I got sentenced to drunk driving school. That morning when I got out of jail on my birthday, I was about 45 pounds more than now. I was in a pair of old Levi's. I'd lost my shoes somewhere, who knows? And I walked home and I remember the feeling, what am I gonna do? I hated everything that was happening in my life, really. And so this drunk driving school was located right next to my apartment building. Very convenient. You go to drunk driving school. They give you long breaks there. They did. And you go home, you have a couple of drinks. You come back to drunk driving school. It was really easy. No problem. I didn't have any problem with it at all. But what happened was a man from Alcoholics Anonymous came and shared. And oh my God, I was that, oh my God, I had forgotten about Alcoholics Anonymous again. And he shared his story, which really, you know, he was my Eskimo. I've never seen him since. I'd look for him. I never saw him again. But he really helped me get back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And what happened was shortly after that, you know, what happened to me the last few months of my drinking is I couldn't get drunk. I couldn't get sober. Couldn't. That's the worst place for an alcoholic ever to be. And I don't understand how this gift is amazing that we get in Alcoholics Anonymous, because on March 19th, 18th, on a Sunday, March 18th, on a Sunday, I was still drinking a quart of vodka every day. And on March 19th, 1973, I had alcoholic convulsions, and I was in a meeting that night, and I haven't had a drink since. That is a gift from God. And here's the deal, you guys. You don't have to clap for the sobriety, because I'm going to tell you something. I still do the same things that I was taught when I was new. I do the same things today. That's the way to stay sober, you know. And I have jumped in with both feet. I've had more fun in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've laughed more, cried more, had more people in my life than I've ever had. And it's a beautiful journey. So I got sober. I went to a meeting that Monday night after these alcoholic convulsions. I knew what they were. And what happened is I got a sponsor. How's that? I got a sponsor. I sat in the front, got a commitment, went to meetings. My sponsor suggested that first year that I go to a meeting every night, 7 nights a week. They don't do that anymore, I'm telling you. I could be a bleeding deacon right now, but I won't. Okay. So I went to 7 meetings a week. I had commitments and I had 2 kids and a full-time job, but I didn't drink. I didn't have time to drink. It was great. And, you know, back then we'd go to coffee shops afterwards, drink coffee, go home at 1, 2 o'clock, go to bed, get up, take the kids to school, go to work and do it over and over. And every 4 or 5 days, I'd have to not go to a coffee shop and go home and go to bed, because it got tiring, but I didn't drink. And the first year of my sobriety was probably my easiest. And I say that because, in my opinion, this is my opinion only, all you have to do is not drink. You don't drink. I did a lot of things that I probably shouldn't have done with men, because you shouldn't be involved, blah, blah. But it was hard for me to, I had to learn how to say no. It wasn't something that came natural for me in the beginning, but I didn't drink no matter what. And that first year, I remember that birthday cakes. In California, we get birthday cakes. And both my kids were happy. Both my kids were different. I'd never abused my kids. I just, in a sense of physically, I just wasn't there emotionally. And I wasn't home that much. But what was I going to say about that? Oh, at the end of my drinking, I have to tell you this one thing. I was like trying to stay home with my kids, you know, every once in a while I felt so guilty. I'm going to go home after work. I'm going to feed them dinner. I'm going to be with my children and be a good mother. Well, it didn't last very often, but when I did that, I would come home and drink and I would serve dinner and we'd have dinner together. And then I'd go into a blackout and serve dinner again. My kids were very confused about the way I was behaving sometimes. So sobriety has given me a fabulous freedom on knowing what's going on, right? It's fabulous. So my first year, I said, was easiest. I got married when I was 1.5 years sober. I do not recommend it. The thing about it is, for me, at 1.5 years, I certainly didn't know all about Susie. It takes a long time to find out all about Susie, much more than 1.5 years. And so I got married at 1.5 years. I remember the wedding because I was sober and there were all sober friends there. In fact, my girlfriend that's having a 50-year party in a couple of weeks was in my wedding, and we're still friends 48 years later. We're still really good friends. And that's because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And now we live 2 blocks away from each other. It's really kind of fun. Anyway, I get married. My husband, Chuck, has 5 kids. I have 2. We have 2 more. We had 9 kids. Now, 3 or 4 of those kids were grown up, that's for sure. But we had a lot of kids. And I was lucky to know that I like children when I got sober. I do. I adore kids. And I have two kids that have never seen me drink. In fact, one of them, or both of them, were in Rennie's wedding, who's here today. And the thing about that is that they totally, all my kids respect my sobriety so much. They're so grateful. And my daughter, when she was a little girl, would put on my high heels. We had high heels then too. Kiss me goodbye and tell me she was going to a meeting. It's kind of what happened at my house. It was all about Alcoholics Anonymous and meetings. Now, she doesn't drink. She's 44. Now, I don't know if she's scared of it or not, but she's the only one of my kids that doesn't drink. She's an amazing lady. But anyway, so we got married, had all these kids, and I would hear people, and I mentioned it in my first year, but my a year and a half sober, and I'm hearing people talk about character defects. Oh my God, you guys, I had no idea what they were. I don't know. It, for me, it's a very, very slow in growing up around here, very slow in being mature, because when I married Chuck, I was still throwing myself on the floor and I wanted what I wanted when I wanted it. And he would leave me there and go to a meeting. I grew up. I hate admitting that. But, you know, I didn't have any patience and I was controlling and all those things that if you're new or in a relationship, you probably know what I'm talking about. They come out in relationships, those character defects. Even if you're sober a while and you get into a relationship, for some reason, they seem to rise their ugly head. And for me, during, you know, I took the steps in the first year, but I'm still every day, I think about, you know, the steps 6 and 7, these character defects can just come from nowhere. And if I'm spiritually fit, which I'll talk about in a minute, they seem to keep away. If I'm spiritually fit and talking to God, they seem to be a little under, so I don't have to worry about them. But it took me a long time. You know, there's those two paragraphs in the big book on 6 and 7. That doesn't do it. And it didn't do it for me. I had to totally become aware and actually be aware of my defect to the point that I had to go to the wall with it. It was really getting ugly. I didn't do anything until it was at the end. And so it took me years to realize and grow up of awareness of these character defects. Today, they're pretty darn good, you know? So Chuck and I were married. Like I said, he liked to wear the pants and so did I. So we both tried to control, which alcoholics are really good at, by the way. I've sponsored enough women to know that. And we sailed off into the sunset, so to speak. Not for long, though. After 17, I was 17 years sober when we got a divorce. I don't know. I wanted the divorce. And, you know, of course, we all have a part. I knew that. You know that now. Everybody has a part in whatever's happening in their life. And as soon as we were divorced, I wanted it. And yet he got a girlfriend. And I was like, that's it. I'm going to drink or kill myself. Not very dramatic, right? And I realized that what happened to me is I really had to look at the program. I mean, I've done everything in AA, everything I've gone through. And at that time, I went back and did the steps. I've only done the steps twice in 48 years. I don't need to look at myself. I need to look at others. I don't believe in a lot of inventories every time you change sponsors. Jeez Louise. It's more thinking about me. But at 17 years, I did an in-depth steps with a guy named Clint H, who was really, really good at it. And it changed my life. It really did. I am not the same person. For some reason, I was able to be kind and loving, it's a new one, to care about other people. It just changed me. I mean, there's people that saw the change that I still sponsor. And it was just revolutionary during the steps like that. And it really changed me. And so I was divorced now. And I knew that, you know, I was single. I had 4 kids left at home. And I thought, I'll just stay in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous and raise 4 kids. And, you know, and I was sponsoring women. I was having a good time. One thing about AA, I've always had fun. I really have. Nothing has to be too serious here. Just stay sober and, you know, take a lot of good action in the program. The thing is all about action. And the thing for me, too, is that I've started doing more prayer and meditation. at that age. It took me a long time. I was going a little bit deeper because I was alone and able to look at me and find out what to do. And I don't know, I think that prayer and meditation is something that you just have to develop. It's also something that I don't care how long you're sober. It took me a long time to do it, but that you have to practice. You know, I had to practice it before I even think I could do it. You know, my head, I don't know about you, but the committee in my head has always been very, very loud. And for me to sit down and meditate, how do you clear that head? You know, it takes something for me. But today, prayer and meditation I do every day. And the thing I do the most in prayer and meditation is do a grateful meditation every morning. I know I'm 48 years sober, but I still do the same things. And I don't wake up grateful every day sometimes. I just don't. So I do a meditation on gratefulness and mindfulness, and it changes my whole outlook on life. So I ended up being single for a while. And I remember people trying to set me up, you know, dinner in a meeting. Oh my God, how fun was that? Woohoo! And it got pretty, kind of boring. And then somebody told me that I should try a normie party. That was awful, awful. These people do not have the language of the heart. They do not have the special stuff we have inside. They'd want to know what my sign was. My sign? Are you kidding me? So that didn't work. That wasn't fun. And so I just stayed in Alcoholics Anonymous for a long time until I met, I knew this guy that was in the Pacific group. I've been from the Pacific group, if you care about it. And I met a guy in the Pacific group who was moving back to Wisconsin with his family. And I went to his going away party, because that's what we do. We go. And his son came to town 20 years later and says to me, "I think you'd have fun with my dad. Do you remember him?" I said, "Yeah, I went to his going away party, la, la, la." He said, "Well, he's divorced now, and so are you." I said, "Well, he's in Wisconsin, and I'm here in Los Angeles." So what happened, to make a long story short, is we started talking to each other on the phone for 2 years. 2 years. I was busy. He was busy. And finally, he invited me to an AA roundup in Wisconsin. He sent me a ticket, and I went to Green Lake, Wisconsin, for a four-day first date. Whoa, that was fun. Whew, nice sober. Anyway, what happened is his son was playing football at Wisconsin, and so I would fly back there every other weekend. So we were dating long distance, and after about 3 months, he got in a car and drove to my house. After 3 months, and drove in, sat down, and we were together. His Clancy was his sponsor, and he didn't tell him. In fact, Clancy didn't speak to him until we were married. But the thing about that relationship, and the reason I really talk about it, is because I'd grown up. I cared about other people. I didn't mind serving him a cup of coffee or making dinner. We cared about each other. We didn't fight. I didn't have to argue over, you know, stuff. I learned you could be right. That's a big one. I remember that phrase. I remember the first time I ever said it. I can tell you what I was wearing and where I was, because I learned that actually in the program of Al-Anon. You could be right. I can't believe how hard that was to say for 25, 30 years. Easy now. And we got married after 5 years of being together, and we got married on the beach in Malibu. And again, his three kids and my four kids with two grandkids on the beach in Malibu. And it was fabulous. This guy and I were, you know, it was my soulmate. He was my favorite husband. I got to tell you that. I've only had three. Not looking for another one. And what happened was he ended up, we went to the Palm Springs Roundup. I don't know if you guys have ever done the powwow. It's a big, really fun event that happens in Palm Desert, California. And 6.5 years ago, he had a heart attack at it and died. And, you know, thank God it was current. Thank God it was with AA, you know, all those things. It was a hard, hard time. Again, this is where I had to go deeper with my God. And it was a difficult time. It was, you know, shock was awful, the shock. And what happened, you know, people give you lots of advice in Alcoholics Anonymous, and people were telling me that, you know, I should go to grief groups, and I should go to this group, and I should go to the Christian one, and I should the handbook. And I'm like, oh my God. So I went to 5 different grief groups. None of them had anything I wanted. None of them had the language of the heart. I knew that my problems can be solved in Alcoholics Anonymous. They have been. And of course, at that point, I was going to a meeting every night. What do you do if your husband dies of a heart attack? You don't sit home. You go to a meeting where your life is, where your friends are, where you have support. And my friend Pat Y lived about three, well, I was in Palm Desert at the time. I just moved here to Seal Beach 3 months ago. So I was in Palm Desert for 15 years with Bob. And Pat Y lived about 300 yards from me. And she came over, knocked on the door, had a backpack on, and moved in for 2 weeks. And it was such a great support. We sat on the couch, we watched Castle every afternoon, my favorite show of the time, and we go to a meeting every night. And you people are the people that helped me get through that. I'm not going to. But I had the love of my life, and I had the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, which has been an incredible, you know, journey. And after Bob passed away, I did the same as I always do. I got back. I went to more meetings. I've sponsored women for a long time. And, you know, I also want to talk a little bit about my career. You know, I worked for lawyers for 30 years, maybe more. And I don't know if there's any lawyers here, but I couldn't stand lawyers any longer. Talk about ego. And I got an opportunity to go to work for this large real estate development company. They own large regional malls across the United States and in Australia and England and blah, blah. And I had a chance to go do that job. And I was the only female executive. I love this job. And I know why I love some of this job. My ego was a little bit involved. I was the executive VP, the only female HR. It's like, oh my God, I loved it. And it was different, you know, it was different for me not working for lawyers, and I really, really enjoyed it. And I got to go to Australia and all that stuff. And at the end of about, 11, 12 years, they hired a guy. I was, 63. They hired a guy in his 30s over me. Oh my God, my ego. I thought I was going to have to kill somebody. I couldn't stand it. My ego, it was killing me. I was going to get a contract out on this guy's life. How's that for being sober? And I would come home every night and Bob would sit and listen to me complain and bitch and moan. It was horrible. I acted terribly. And I said to the guy that took my job, you can take my title, but you can't take my money, because I know that about being over 44 and being in human resources. So I said, okay, I'll stay. I'm not going. I'm not leaving. And he put me somewhere else. And I had a big resentment. I really did. And I don't know, after praying, whatever happened in my life, I prayed and prayed every day for this guy. And what happened one day, I decided that I would help him. I would show him where the bodies were. I'd be a kind and loving person to him. This is not Susie, let me tell you, because I still want that big job, you know. But he didn't take my money. And so I went in and I helped him. And of course, I lost the resentment. And finally, after being there a couple of years, he asked me what it would take to retire. I said, well, I can write it up. you can give me this and that and get insurance for both of us. And I made this huge severance agreement, and I left. But I'm grateful that I left that resentment too. You know, I can't afford those. This was an ugly one, a big one. And so I retired. And the thing about that was, he gave me a retirement party. He didn't know I couldn't stand him. That's what the program can do, you know. What else? Well, I was going to say something about, for me, the hardest, you know, this hardest part of this program for me has always been bringing it home. You know, I could look good at an AA meeting because I'm supposed to, and I can shake your hands, and I've done a lot of commitments, and I've been very active, and I can do my job because they give me a paycheck. But for many years, I'd go home and be not nice, not nice at all. I don't know why, but it's the last part of most of our programs is living with the people we love. I think it's the hardest part to practice. You know, I really do. But today, I'll just say, the other thing about my AA program, and I'm just going to mention it because I just sent something out to my sponsees about this. I've always exercised for 48 years because of that committee in my head. The first 5 years, or I guess the first 4 years, I would have my jogging shoes by my bed and I would go running every morning, 5 miles a day. And I'll tell you what it does for you. You get high. It feels so good if you're a jogger. You know what I'm talking about. And then I got involved with yoga, and they even had a class before work for me at 6 o'clock in the morning. And there's another thing that helped me spiritually, is to be at peace. I'm a lunatic if I don't do all this. I'm telling you, my head's going crazy, and it calmed me down. And I even ended up teaching yoga, and I did yoga for 40 years. And, it was the best part of my program. Any kind of exercise, you guys, just to get your head away, open. And then the last few years, I've been swimming. And that's just as good as everything else, let me tell you. But exercise for me has been a huge, important part of, you know, my sobriety. Today, I'm in this. Okay, let me tell you one thing. I sold this 4-bedroom, 4-bath house in Palm Desert, with a beautiful pool, and the grandkids love coming out, you know, before Bob passed away, and everybody came and they were young. They were here every other weekend. And then the grandkids have grown up and been in sports, and so they don't come every weekend. And so I have this big 4-bedroom house after Bob passed away, and I needed to sell it. Actually, to be honest with you, financially, I needed to sell it. And I sold this house. I moved in here December 12th into this 750 square foot place, and I love it. It's just perfect. It's perfect. I have a living room, a kitchen, a bathroom, and a bedroom. I don't need anything else. I mean, I'm outside most of the time anyway. I live a mile and a half from the beach, with this beautiful pier, and it's beautiful here. And you know, it's the first time in my life, and I said this to my sponsor, who almost fainted. I don't have a want for anything. I'm really okay more than ever in my life. I've always wanted something. I don't care if it's a new dress, a new car, new earrings, whatever. I have no wants today. I'm not saying that'll happen forever, but that's the way it is today. I really, you know, this program is about love and kindness. If you take nothing else out of this today, it's how to have love and kindness and take action. You know, don't sit around and wait. Take action. That's the only way to practice this program. Like I said, I do the same things. I say my prayer and meditation. I swim. I go to a lot of meetings. I speak when asked. I sponsor women, which is the best part of AA for me. And it's the same things I did 48 years ago. So if you're here, I hope you jump in here with both feet. That's it, David.
Thank you, Susie. That was wonderful.
Well, I have no idea what time it is, but that's all I can do.
Oh, you're perfect. I'm going to allow everybody to unmute for the moment. And thanks, Susie.
Beautiful, Susie.
Thank you.
Thank you, Susie.
Thank you.
That was awesome.
Thank you, Susie.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you for coming tonight, Susie.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. I'm going to go ahead and take the meeting back for the moment. We'll give Susie a break. I've placed a link in the chat for the seventh tradition, which states, second plea for questions. Any questions? We're going to stick around for another 30 minutes or so. If you have any questions at all about Alcoholics Anonymous, about Susie's journey, please throw them in the chat to the user questions, and then we'll get to reconvene in a few minutes and we'll interview Susie. The seventh tradition states that while contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their inner group, central office, local services, district, area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Our common welfare, a word about safety. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meeting can take place. Are there any announcements for the good of AA? Where's my ebony? All right, I'll throw a couple up here real quick while you guys are thinking about it. Let's see. We got this home group, Simple Actions, super excited about the Family Afterward workshop, which is going to be on Wednesday, June 2nd from 7 to 8:30. We've got a mother and son, Polly P. and her son, James L. I think Polly's 50 years sober and her son's 30 years sober. Anyway, they give a wonderful presentation on the family afterward. So they'll do their thing and we'll also have a Q&A that night. This information is on the TidewaterInnergroup.org website, as well as this information on throughout 2021 on the fourth Wednesday of every month, District 14 is sponsoring a concepts workshop. So the next one in the rotation will be the fourth Wednesday in May. Sorry, I don't have the date, but we'll do the fifth concept that night. We've been having the past delegates come in and share with us. So again, both of those events are on the TidewaterInnergroup.org. Anybody else? You're free to unmute if you like. All righty then. Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group or in need of a sponsor, please hang out after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your hands. Sponsorship. Sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, we will be available here. After we close this meeting, please stick around. You may have come in alone, but you do not have to leave that way. Or if you're shy, feel free to send an email to info@simpleactions.net. So before we reconvene here, I'm going to make one more call for your questions to go to the user questions. It's really Larry, who's kind enough to wrangle the questions. Susie, that was wonderful. Thank you so much. You made reference to this, and it's an old story, and probably the old timers know it, but I'm wondering, for the benefit of us agnostics, would you tell the Eskimo story, please? You referred to an Eskimo when you were talking about the drunk driving school. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. Well, you know, I've been in and out of AA, you know, by that time for 3 years. And for some reason, you know, I couldn't hear. I didn't hear people. I wasn't willing to hear. I just, you know how that is. My ears weren't open and I wasn't willing to do anything. Today, I'm willing to do anything, trust me. But at some point, which is such a great, you never know who your Eskimo is going to be. But this guy spoke. His name was Wayne. At drunk driving school. And what happened to me is like a spiritual experience. I was just, he told his story and I had so much identification that I call it like it was a turn on. I mean, like the light went on and oh my God, that's what I have to do. And that's my Eskimo story. I love that. I remember it. I still remember it, which is really kind of cool, you know? Yeah. So that's my Eskimo story.
So please go ahead and be a bleeding deacon if you like. How has AA changed over the last 48 years, for the worse or for the better? Any comment? Oh,
yeah, I have lots of comments.
Please.
Well, I'm not going to be a bleeding deacon. Here's the deal. And I know this is really an age thing, but 48. I know that. But it seemed to me that people 48 years ago were really in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, both seats. They were desperate when they came. And I believe the biggest change is treatment centers. I think they're disgusting. I even taught yoga at a treatment center. And these parents paid for $35,000 for their kids to come. The kid doesn't want to be here. The kid doesn't desperate. He doesn't want to give it up, but the parents shove him in. They shove kids in treatment centers because they don't know any better. I'm not saying it's, I just think it's ridiculous because the people that I dealt with in treatment centers, they didn't care about being sober. They didn't turn out sober. They went in and out for a long time. And I was desperate. There were no treatment centers. We had honey and orange juice to walk with when we first got sober, to get us sober. We didn't go to treatments and found out what your mother thought and, you know, oh my God, my mother did this. There is none of that shit. You need to be desperate. That's the clue. That's my my take on it. And I really believe that people aren't as interested or respectful. I hate to go to a meeting where, you know, they're all young and they're all chit-chatting during the meeting and they're, you know, doing all this, getting up and getting down. You're supposed to be disciplined. It's such a great discipline thing for your life to be able to sit still in an AA meeting. It's amazing. We learn that and we learn how to do that in our life. I know it might sound crazy to you, but it really does work. If you have respect in Alcoholics Anonymous, you learn how to do that with your family and your job and everything else in your life. So these people that think they can do whatever they want and get up and get their grapes or whatever they're serving, I don't believe in it. It makes me crazy. That's my answer. Sorry.
No. I
did have an opinion and I really believe it. Sorry, but it's try it my way. Try by being respectful.
Now that's the first thing they ask us to do is sit down for an hour and it is difficult. But somebody's got to tell you, you sit in the front row. You sit down.
Right. And yeah. Don't you have nothing to share. That's the other thing. These young people think they should share. I was told to shut up for a year. To listen, I had nothing to say. I didn't have any recovery. Oh, I wish it was like that again. I get kind of upset. Anyway.
How did you come to learn to be aware of these defects of character?
I didn't until they slammed me to the wall. I'm trying to think of an example. You know, when they stop working and you're really uncomfortable or people are pointing it out, I was able to give a couple of them up. It's interesting. Really, I didn't give up anything unless I was so desperate to get rid of it, because I don't just give up. Gee, I'm impatient. Oh, so what? You know, I had to go to the wall with the defect where I got in trouble with other people or in trouble with my life. Or I was embarrassed to the fact that I better do something. I better change. And I didn't do anything until I got to that wall, really. In fact, you know, in the beginning, some of them I thought were cute. They were part of my personality, right? They're not. They weren't. But I thought they were. In fact, only 3 years ago. Oh, this is embarrassing. 3 years ago. So I was what, like 45 years sober. My sponsor pointed out that I was very sarcastic and it really wasn't very nice anymore. And it wasn't part of your personality. And being sarcasm is really like tearing flesh. I was like, what? She said, I really ought to think about giving it up. It's not cute anymore. I was 45 years sober until I gave that one up. Okay. The thing about the program is there's always something to work on. I love it. You're always working on something in your life, on your journey, whatever. So I never gave them up until they were really killing me. And I think that most people are. Why do you want to give anything up unless it's you're desperate to get rid of it? Why? Just like alcohol.
So I have a question here that was submitted. I have been sober for quite a while now. And every time I get into a relationship, my character defects come to the surface, just as you described. What was it about the second round of steps that changed you?
I can't tell you the answer to that. I don't know. I don't know for sure. I don't know if it was total willingness. Remember, I was just going to be going through a divorce which I really wanted, but how painful it was. And I'm quite sure that most of my defects were alive and well, and I was able to see them. It's an interesting question. I appreciate the question. But again, you know, if it's happening, you've got to be aware of it. You got to write a 10th step on it. You got to, you know, the thing about this program is you've got to practice no matter what you're going through, no matter what you're trying to do. This whole thing is about practice. The question's great. I wish I had a magic answer about that, but I think I was desperate enough to change. And let's hope you are too. I mean, when it comes to that, desperation and practice. And, you know, try everything. Try everything before, because I think I was, you know, the thing about that at 17 years sobriety, I wanted to drink, to be honest. And I knew, you know, I had called somebody every day for 17 years, thank God. And that's why that training is about calling your sponsor. And then in the beginning, we had to call three other people. You know, that's another thing you just do, because when you get into trouble, like I was at 17, I wasn't afraid to pick up that phone, and we didn't have cell phones then. So I just hope this person understands what I'm saying. And I hope you're desperate enough to say, oh, how about reading Drop the Rock book? It's not AA, but it's an amazing, amazing book on character defects. It helps a lot. So I hope that helps. I know it's not easy. Part of growing up.
No reason for profanity.
Who wants to be mature anyway? You know, I'm almost, what am I going to be, close to 80, and I still am not very mature, right?
Me neither.
Much more fun.
Would you like to share a little bit about what being a home group member has meant to your sobriety?
Oh, it's meant everything. You know, when I was in and out of AA, of course, I never let anybody get to know you. And that's one of the greatest reasons is to have a home group. And I ended up in the Pacific group. I didn't know I was there. Okay. I didn't know. And the greatest thing about that is you get to know other people. They can call you on your shift. They can call you when you're not at a meeting. People would know where you are. I think that's one of the most beautiful things I've ever learned. When I got sober, there were about 200 of us. You know, now there was, I don't know how many after Clancy died, but we looked out for each other. We all did our fifth step at the same time. We had classes. I'm the class of 73. There were 50 of us. There's still 23 of us. And we did things like that together in these relationships. You learn to have coffee after with somebody, or you pick somebody up. I love the growing up, and they knew who I was. They could see when I was in trouble. They knew when I was happy. And we just all helped each other out. And that's what groups that get to know you do. I mean, this friend of mine, it's going to be 50 middle of May. I mean, she and I palled around for 48 years, and we got into a lot of problems, but we didn't drink, but we had fun. We had fun. We had kids together, all this stuff. And so home groups really know. I feel like other people are hiding. If you're going to different meetings every day and night, that's baloney. You need to be in a group that gets to know you and can call you on your stuff and love you on your stuff. And just, it's a marvelous, marvelous. Home groups are great.
And then you mentioned it's also important to take a commitment. What do you mean by that?
Well, when I first got sober, I didn't know what it meant either, but I think all of us here hopefully know what they are. But what happened for me is I'd get a commitment either, you know, like greeting people at the door, which I didn't want to do. I want you to know. I never wanted to do a commitment. I do. Okay. I'm fine now with it. But my sponsor suggested that I get a commitment at every meeting I went to. And what happened there is that I didn't miss meetings, first of all. I cared about my commitment. I don't miss commitments. I believe that's part of what keeps me sober. And I remember a couple of times thinking, oh, if I could just stay home. But I had a commitment. I had to bring the cookie. Or, you know, I was a secretary. It made me stay close, and it didn't let me run away. And the biggest thing about it is it made me feel a part of. I still love commitments. When I moved to the desert, I was like 34, 35 years sober. And I took a commitment to mop the floors at the women's meeting. And they found out how long I was sober. And they told me I couldn't do it. I said, oh, yes, I can. I'll do the mop. I want to stay sober. It doesn't make any difference what commitment I have. It's a part of, too, of your group. Or, you know, I got to know people by washing dishes. We don't have those cups anymore, but we had real cups in the beginning. And we'd wash cups together in the kitchen, and we get to know each other. You know, you stand in line with a bunch of people to greet people. You get to know the people around you. And you feel like you're in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the best feel in town. Mm.
You talked about the hardest part is bringing it home, you know, living with the people I love.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any more in there? What's hard about that?
Why be nice to people at home? I mean, I felt like I had to, if I went to a meeting, I had to put my hand out and be nice. That's what I was taught, right? I had to do it. I wasn't grumpy at a meeting. I was nice. I put my hand out. I shook hands. I did whatever. And it made me feel better, right? And the boss, God, with a paycheck, I wasn't gonna blow the job. But when I got home, nobody was there to control me. And they were I don't know why it was hard. I felt like I could give in and I didn't have to be, I don't know what it was. I'm sure a lot of you have this experience, please. I'm not the only one. But I felt like if I didn't want to be nice, I didn't have to. And if I didn't want to do the, you know, I didn't have to. I could yell at the kids or whatever. I don't know what, maybe because there's no reward until I learned that I really loved the people around me and they were the most important people in my life. And I should be nice to them and I could be nice to them. You know, there's a lot of fear involved in you know, this first part of sobriety where loving family and loving and being kind, and it's pretty scary, I think. And so it was pointed out to me that I might try practicing, maybe saying, how was your day? You know, stuff. I had to practice with small stuff. I didn't want to come in the door like I did for many years at this big job and cyclone with four kids and oh my God, where's the food? It was just so busy sometimes. And, but my attitude was kind of, you know, after being on the LA freeways, and I had to change that attitude. I remember driving home and praying and saying, God, help me when I go through the door tonight to act kind and loving, not be, act. It's the difference. And when I started acting kind and loving, I got it in return. And it was a lot more peace at home. But it was the last piece of the puzzle for me. So I think you have to act your way into this, you guys.
Hmm. I have another question submitted. Can you share a little bit more about your morning gratitude and mindful meditation?
More about it?
Yeah, okay. People are interested in the practice.
Yeah, there's such, first of all, 5 years ago or so, I've always had a sponsor, by the way. And I hate to admit this, but she said to me, you know, what are you doing about, you know, your prayer med? I don't know. I read, you know, some of this little books and blah, blah. She says, I want you to read 86 to 88 every day and you haven't been doing it. And I said, no, I haven't. Why would I want to do that? I can't believe I said that to her. She looked at me. Anyway, I read 86 to 88 every day. I read something in the Daily Reflection. And on YouTube, there are two or three of grateful meditations, morning grateful meditation. There's one about mindfulness and meditation. There's one about positivity and gratitude. It turns me on. I mean, I even did it with my sponsee meeting last Sunday on Zoom. We did a meditation, and it just talks about how to behave and to love the people in your life and be grateful for what you have. And so there's a whole bunch of them on YouTube. And I don't do more than 14 minutes of meditation. My head wouldn't let me. But I do take the time every morning. to do that. And you should look them up, seeing what you want to, you know, which kind you want. But I thought I'd start with something, you know, on the subject. And right now it said I have to wake up and do a grateful meditation because I think, you know, my kids are gone, blah, 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 blah. But it always helps me to do that. And that has nothing to do with the question. Seal Beach, just because I'm a family. I'm 20 minutes from my grandkids, and I have seven of my grandkids, and they all play big sports. And so I'm able to drive up there on the weekends and I get to see them do this, you know. That has nothing to do with meditation, but I thought I'd tell you anyway. But it makes me happy is the whole part of that.
All right. Let's see. We're coming down to our last couple of questions. So I'm going to offer a last call. If you want to get one in. So I don't know if this is a process question, but I'll just read the question as submitted and see if there's anything in there. You mentioned the second time you took the steps that it was a different way. That's in quotes. Can you share a little bit on how it was different, or were you different, or was it different? Was there a process difference?
The process was different. I've never done the steps in columns. I don't really love it. And I can tell you why. It's just putting those columns in, and it affected my pride, my ego. It doesn't connotate any kind of feeling, in my opinion. I don't have my sponsees do that. My first inventory was Clancy's seven questions. When I did it with Clint, he went through the book line by line, all the questions in the book, all the prayers in the book, the deep inventory. It wasn't the columns, but it was everything else, answering all the questions that are in the book. Why? It was a different process, but I was in a different place. I was in a place I wanted to drink. I wanted out. And I hadn't changed enough, to be honest with you. I don't know how to explain that, except that I've spoken at several meetings recently, and there were several people that have had that experience between 12 and 17 years of sobriety where they really needed to do something and done something. So this was line by line of the book. And it was fascinating. And the forgiveness in there was tremendous. I had an ex-husband that we had a huge forgiveness experience between us. And it was just in more depth, you guys. If you read the 164 pages line by line, there's a lot in there. And it changed me. I heard it. That's the best answer I can give. It's a good question, but some of this is hard to explain. You know what I mean? But it was the big book, big book.
Did you guys do that together or over the phone?
Yeah.
Or?
Yeah. No. Oh, I was 17. We did it in his house every Saturday, I believe it was.
All right. So the last question that I have for you was submitted. How will I know when I'm ready to sponsor someone?
You don't have to be ready. You're ready if you're sober. Have you done the steps? Have your sponsor help you do it with the next one. I've got my newest sponsee just turned 2 yesterday. And she's got a sponsee. If you're 60 days sober, you can have a sponsee. You can give them what you have. Whatever you have, you're able to sponsor somebody, even if it's 60 days sober. You know how to go to meetings in 60 days. You know how to call a sponsor every day. And you just follow along what you've done. It's the greatest reward ever is sponsoring people. I love it. It keeps me on my toes. You don't have to be sober, you know, more than 30 days if you want. Just stay ahead of them.
Just stay ahead of them.
Yeah.
Has the pandemic in the last year, has that changed the way you sponsor and work with people, or?
The pandemic, well, I don't know. I don't think so. Well, I don't get to see them as often. We used to have a lot of coffee. I mean, my sponsees and I get together on Zoom, all of them together. We're doing some readings. I've done some book work with a couple on just FaceTime. So it's changing the fact that I don't physically see these people. That's, I can't wait to get a hug. I can't wait to do that. I can't wait to love you and hug you. And, oh, I mean, that's the best part of our program, is this love that we can give each other by hugging and seeing. So Zoom hasn't been easy for any of us, but I don't know. I think some of the girls that I thought were a little kind of not going to quite as many meetings, I think they've all doubled their meetings. It's been really good to be able to not drive to a meeting, but after work, just turn on a Zoom meeting and get extra meetings in. That part I've loved. You know, there's times when I've gone to 6 and 7 meetings just because, just turn on the Zoom button and you're on, and it's, that part's great. But I do miss people. I'm going to my first live meeting. I can't believe I'm saying this in front of Rennie. Rennie, are you there? Yeah, you are. I'm going to a live meeting on Monday, tomorrow. They're kind of pushing Seal Beach speakers meeting. So I'm going to go try it. It probably will be, you know, one of my home group meetings. I'm going to be all new meetings when we go live. You know, I'm still hanging on to my old Palm Desert meetings, but Zoom has made it not as much fun. That's all. I'm, you know, I don't love it. I can't wait to see everybody.
I know you're not alone in that.
Yeah.
I did get a question, and you mentioned Al-Anon. Have any of your kids come down with the alcoholism?
Oh God, who knows? My original four. No, they've been mostly drinkers. My youngest is going to be 38 this month, my baby. And he's certainly practicing alcoholism, and it's painful to watch. And then it's a long story, but his wife is on the streets now, and he has 4 kids. And so his drinking has curtailed. None of my kids have gone to Al-Anon. They claim they don't need it. We've never had a problem among us at all. Remember, I was sober for my last two. My first two were younger, and it's just, I don't know. I went to Al-Anon for several years because I was horrible. I was just a control freak.
All right.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, I don't think there's much else that, I don't know what else to say. No, my 3 boys drink, and my daughter doesn't drink. She's a Baha'i, and she's a very spiritual lady. That's what my family is right now, my 4 original kids. My oldest daughter, Bob's oldest daughter, is in Al-Anon. I don't know. The kids are all over the place, but they're all okay today. How's that?
Perfect.
That's all I can ask for sometimes.
All right. Well, thank you so much. You've been so generous with your time. Everybody's going to get an opportunity to thank Susie again after the Lord's Prayer. I'd like to thank everybody who showed up tonight and made this a wonderful meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome again, Marcus, to Simple Actions. Thank you, Larry, for the questions. Leanne, for co-hosting, and just you guys just being the sparkling, wonderful people that you are. I didn't ask anybody, nor did I give any permissions. So let me do that now and ask if our dear Debbie would read the last 2 paragraphs on page 164.
Sure. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Debbie. A vision for you, big book, page 164. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank everybody. So how about we virtually circle up? and hold hands. Feel free to unmute and we can have a confusing
cacophony.
Cacophony. Thank you. That's such a tasty word. We'll have a moment of silence to do with as you wish, followed by the Lord's Prayer. Our Father. Our Father, Amen.
Thank you, Susie.
Thank you so much.
To all of you. Thank you.